High, 65 degrees Kenosha, 64 for Racine, Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. If you are tuning into the Thursday morning show expecting to hear about the great Bo Jackson, one of the great athletes of the 20th century, fear not. You'll be hearing from best-selling author Jim Perlman, the author of The Last Folk Hero, in just a few minutes. But we're actually beginning today's morning show with a good friend of the morning show, Dr. James Kinchin, Director of Choral Activities at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. We're going to be spending part one of today's program talking about a performance that's coming up this weekend, specifically Saturday evening in the Francis Bedford Concert Hall at Parkside, of a piece by Ludwig van Beethoven that is among the most intriguing that he ever wrote, his Choral Fantasy. And this is a performance that is going to be conducted by Dr. James Kinchin. And this is a work for orchestra, chorus, and pianist. And at the piano, playing the solo, will be Alfred Jamal Kinchin. And it's no coincidence that these two musicians have the same last name. Alfred Jamal Kinchin is indeed Dr. Kinchin's son and a talented pianist. And so father-son sharing the stage. But mostly we're going to be talking about Beethoven today and this really interesting work, his Choral Fantasy, and this rare opportunity to hear this piece played before you. So, Dr. Kinchin, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Good morning, Greg. Thank you so much. It's a delight to be back with you.
Glad we can do this. So I think one of the things we should begin with is the very intriguing story behind this Choral Fantasy. I mean, it is such an odd work. In fact, a lot of people have called it sort of unprecedented or unparalleled. I mean, there really isn't another work exactly like it in terms of the musical elements that come together. Tell our listeners a little bit about the work itself and what you know about the circumstances under which Beethoven composed this.
Well, so the work itself received its world premiere performance on December 22nd of 1808. So that's like 3 days before Christmas, okay? And it there was a program, and I think the circumstances is really an interesting story there. There was a program that was being featured by the Academy of Music in Vienna under the auspices of no less than Ludwig van Beethoven. And it was like just something that you and I would have trouble imagining, wrapping our minds around. It was a huge, huge, huge program. So on the program was the public premiere of his Concerto Number 4 in G, mm-hmm. Piano Concerto Number 4 in G, and right. Beethoven, of course, played you expect he would. And it was also the world premiere, check this out, of his Immortal Symphony Number 5.
Da, 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 da.
Yes. It's the first time it was heard was at that program, and his Symphony Number 6, the completely different pastoral, as it's been nicknamed.
Right, okay? The five movements, programmatic, one of the greatest musical thunderstorms in music history, part of Fantasia. Great, important work.
Yeah, and by the way, you know, a couple of movements from his Mass in C, and an aria as well.
Perfido.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Yes. So, he decided at the fairly much the last minute that he needed something more for the program, as if we could imagine a program like that needing more. And the something more was going to be this composition that would take advantage of all of the performing forces that were there. Because you had the full orchestra, you had, you know, the piano, and he was just an awesome pianist. You had a choir, and you had soloists. And so he, at the last minute, wrote this fantasy, for what we now call the choral fantasy, for the conclusion of that concert. That was the big finale to a program that really needed no big
right,
finale.
Exactly. And already a marathon, and one imagines probably an unheated church in late December.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. For sure. It was unheated. That's documented. Somebody thought that they would mention the fact that there was no heat in the place, and it was a four-hour concert. Four hours.
And this choral fantasy, combining all of these interesting elements together, as you said, was conceived for this special occasion and yet another world premiere. As far as we know, is this work pretty much unprecedented? That is there any indication that anybody before this had ever written a piece combining forces in this way?
As far as we know, there is no other piece that it can be really compared to. We talked about the Fifth and Sixth Symphony. Well, you know, there's a precedence for the symphony, both in terms of Beethoven's use of it, and before him, Mozart and Haydn, and concerto, same there. But this choral fantasy was a one-of-its-kind sort of thing.
Sort of a musical platypus in terms of all the different elements put together. And, of course, the thing that's really interesting about it is, in some ways, it's a precursor to the much better-known finale to his Ninth Symphony, the so-called Ode to Joy. But that doesn't have this elaborate piano part. Doesn't have any piano in it at all. This really is an utterly unique piece.
It is.
Something else that I have read about this extraordinary concert from December of 1808 is that, and I'm curious if you know this to be true and can confirm, that this was the last time that Beethoven appeared in public as a pianist.
I don't know that for a fact, but I'm not surprised because really, I think around the late 1880s, he began to have issues with his ears. And then he moved to Vienna right around,
1780s, yes.
And he moved to Vienna, and then it got progressively worse. And, of course, medical science was not nearly as scientific as it is now.
Right.
And so all the things that he was trying with doctors was to no avail, and he was losing his hearing. And, in fact, at this particular concert, it seemed to have played some role in the performance itself. Mm. But it's like at this point, after this concert, he begins to do more of the introspective thing, which is composing in his own private space, and less of the thing of performing in public, because his hearing is going.
I thought it would be interesting to hear just a few moments from the very opening of the Choral Fantasy, which is the piano on its own before all of these other forces come in. And we'll sample a little bit of the finale towards the end of our time. But here's the very opening of this Choral Fantasy.
And by the way, the last part of it that was actually written down on paper.
Ah.
At the performance, he improvised this whole piano piece.
Wow.
Yeah.
And there's a real interesting sort of poignancy, I think, to this music. So here is how this Choral Fantasy by Ludwig van Beethoven begins.
Thank you.
the opening to Beethoven's Choral Fantasy. As I think mentioned early in the interview, the pianist who is going to be joining forces with Dr. Kinchin and the Parkerside Orchestra and the University Chorale and the Master Singers will be one Alfred Jamal Kinchin, playing the piano solo. So, Dr. Kinchin, tell us a little bit about Alfred Jamal Kinchin and also about the invitation that I assume you issued to him to come be part of this performance.
And I am just incredibly pleased and proud and grateful to him for accepting and proud to be able to be collaborative with him in this performance. He began studying piano at quite a young age, and I have to give a shout out to his amazing teacher, Anna Koyevich, who did just a superb job of bringing him from feet not touching the floor and playing a little one-line melodies to the point of doing sonatas and etudes and those kinds of things. But he went on to study at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. And he had a dual major. It was piano performance and aviation. And that is reflective of, I guess, his wide-ranging interests. He was very successful in his matriculation. And so we began to kind of talk about the idea of him doing something. And that was sort of like, in terms of what involves choir and piano and orchestra, that was sort of like the thing that we began to gravitate toward. He was very warm to the idea. Even as he pursues his life, down in Southern Illinois now. He graduated last year. He's consented to work on it and to prepare it on that end. And so, I'm so honored to have him. My biggest goal when we do that performance will be to stand at the podium and be the conductor and he be the pianist and not get too emotionally entangled with the fact of him being my son playing.
Right. Trying not to be dad. I mean,
are
dad, but you have to wear that mantle of responsibility as conductor first and foremost in the performance itself. So you had mentioned that he flew in rather late last night, so I'm assuming that there's been absolutely no rehearsal with the two of you as of
Not at all, not as of yet.
So what do you foresee as being kind of the challenge of putting all of these different elements together, and what kind of challenges does this work present?
Well, it presents challenges of different types for everybody, and I think that probably as much as it can possibly be, and the conductor is always sort of the one that kind of holds things together, that really is my responsibility of pulling all the pieces together. Obviously, after the excerpt that you played, the complete first section of this, then that's when the second section begins, which is essentially theme and variations, except that some of the variations almost become development in a sense. They're that elaborate. The orchestra is sort of having dialogue, musical dialogue with the pianist, and it is not until the final section that we hear the voices enter. There's a trio of female singers who become the first voices to be heard, followed by a trio of male singers, and then in the tutti section, the whole choir sings, and it's this really glorious sound, which, as you say, is reminiscent in many ways of the An der Freude, the Ode to Joy, that he uses later for the Ninth Symphony.
Right. And I'm going to say something that I know a lot of people would disagree with or think is heretical, but as someone who's not particularly fond of the finale to the Ninth Symphony, I just think it's a real big screaming match after a while. I really think the choral writing in this work is superior to the Ninth Symphony. I mean, it's really beautifully crafted, and for the strange creature that it is in terms of the things put together, it really has wonderful impact. Quickly, my understanding is that there's kind of a mystery about who wrote the text for this piece.
And there is, and I should have made note of the specific names, but there are two names that are, depending on what your source is, given attribution for it. And you know, one of them is supposed to have done it, and then Beethoven's student later came along and said, no, that's not the one who did it. It was someone else who did it. And it's compounded by the fact that everything was done for this work in a hurry. So that's not exactly clear who the author of the text is. But the text is very much in the same spirit as the Schiller text for the Ninth, which is sort of like music as this kind of unifier, powerful force that brings together the human community.
Right. Although that's really nice, a nice summary of what this text says. And, of course, Beethoven's Radiant Music supports that so very, very well. So we're talking Thursday morning. How many rehearsals before Saturday night's concert?
Two.
Ooh, okay.
Let me know the edge.
Wow. So one today and one tomorrow? Or?
One tomorrow and one actually earlier Saturday.
Okay, so so young Alfred gets to recover from his jet lag and be fresh as a daisy and ready to undertake this wonderful wonderful work. So this is Saturday evening, 7 p.m. in beautiful Francis Bedford Concert Hall, one of the loveliest performing spaces in southeastern Wisconsin, ensconced there in the RITA, Regional Center for, I haven't said it in a while, for Arts and Humanities.
Regional Center for Arts and Humanities. That's
okay.
Good.
So, and I think you can go to uwp.edu for ticket information.
Yes.
And this will, of course, involve the University Chorale and Master Singers and Orchestra. And on the podium, conductor and proud father as well, Dr. James Kinchin, leading this performance of the Choral Fantasy of Beethoven. And we're going to hear the last bit of this wonderful work to finish out part one of today's morning show. Dr. Kinchin, I'm so glad we got to sneak this in. This was really great to be able to talk about this. Best wishes to you, to your son Alfred, and to all the musicians involved in Saturday night's performance of Beethoven's Choral Fantasy.
Thank you so much, Greg. It's always a pleasure.
And here it is, the last bit of this intriguing work by Beethoven. Eight 28 here on WGTD, and that was the final minutes of Beethoven's Choral Fantasy being performed Saturday evening at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. You're listening to the morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg, and here's part two. On two previous occasions, I've had the great pleasure on the morning show of speaking with best-selling author Jeff Perlman. We spoke about his book Gunslinger, The Remarkable, Improbable, Iconic Life of Brett Favre, of course, the great longtime quarterback of the Green Bay Packers. We also spoke, in fact, I think most recently, about his book Football for a Buck, The Crazy Rise and Crazier Demise of the USFL. And although I didn't get to speak with Mr. Perlman about it, I also have read his wonderful book Sweetness about the legendary Chicago Bear, Walter Payton. His most recent book is an extraordinary achievement indeed, because he is taking on the incredible life and legacy of one of the greatest athletes of the 20th century, Bo Jackson. Still, I believe, the only professional baseball player and football player to be an all-star at the pro level in both of those sports. And someone also who is in some ways difficult to penetrate in terms of understanding him and what makes him tick. Jeff Perlman's done an incredible job with his book, which is called The Last Folk Hero, The Life and Myth of Bo Jackson, published by Mariner Books. And Jeff Perlman, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here. I don't want to brag, but I'm sitting in the La Quinta Inn in Birmingham, Alabama, $71 a night, and I just ate a bowl of Fruit Loops. So try competing with that.
Ah, that is the life of glory for a best-selling author. That's great. let's first of all explain to listeners, I mean, it's clear once you read the book, but I don't think at a glance people will necessarily understand why your book would be called The Last Folk Hero. Explain why Bo Jackson, in your mind, and in the mind of some others as well, is something of a folk hero, and the kind of folk hero that we are unlikely to ever see again.
Well, you know, he is the he's a guy who came along pre-social media, and there are a million stories, Bo Jackson stories, almost like there are a million stories about Jim Thorpe, who, you know, obviously did his things about 40 years before Bo. There's a million stories of, did you see that catch? You wouldn't believe it, but this ball, he hit, dented a truck. You wouldn't believe it, but he made it to third base on a pop-up before the ball touched the ground. You wouldn't believe it, but he ran over four people. Like, there are more you wouldn't believe it stories about Bo Jackson than any athlete of my lifetime. And most of them are not caught on film, and most of them aren't caught on tape, and a lot of them weren't even written about. So in that regard, I consider him very much a folk hero. The writer Joe Posnanski was the first guy to actually call him the last folk hero, and he was referring to his famous throw when he was playing for the Royals, and he threw out Harold Reynolds of the Mariners at home. And it's probably one of the most famous throws in baseball history, but if you look closely, the video never actually shows Bo releasing the ball because it was only a one-camera shot, so the camera goes to Harold Reynolds running third. So it's like, did he throw the ball? Did he not throw the ball? We assume he threw the ball because he got the ball. But in modern days, there'd be 17 different angles of that throw. And in the old days, there were no angles of that throw. So very folk hero-esque.
You write at one point, he was the last legendary athlete to do impossible to conceive feats without the benefit or curse of 1,000 camera angles. I mean, every iota of an athlete's exploits are now captured by both professional photographers and amateur photographers in the stands. And yes, there's little left to our imagination the way there is with someone like Bo Jackson. Early on in the book, you talk about how you spoke for about a half hour with Bo Jackson, who otherwise did not cooperate in the writing of this book in the way that you had hoped. And he kind of alluded to the fact that, as Bo Jackson did, of how hard it would be to write a Bo Jackson book, and you ultimately agreed with him. You said writing a Bo book was hard. What was hardest about writing this book about Bo Jackson?
Oh, man. I mean, I could give you a million. Number one, writing it during a pandemic, which limited the amount of travel, and I really do like to travel and see the places I'm writing about. I was able to go to his hometown, Bessemer. I was able to go to Auburn, but I wanted more. Number two, he's a really reluctant subject. You know, I called him early on. He spoke for about a half hour. He was very friendly, but sort of adamant. I don't want to participate. I don't mind that you're writing a book. It just doesn't interest me. His verifying myths, sports myths, is actually very hard because you get a million stories from people who saw things, but you get a million different stories One story might involve, you know, a baseball breaking a window, but another story might involve the same hit, but it slammed into a concrete wall. So trying to figure out what is right, what really happened, what didn't happen. I got really lucky. I got really, really lucky. I was researching this book, struggling a little, and I found out that when Auburn University, before he died, the legendary journalist Dick Schaap, who wrote Bo's autobiography in 1990, Bo Knows Bo, donated all his notes, all the audio recordings of all his interviews with Bo Jackson from 1989 to 90 to the Auburn Library, and they'd gone untouched for 30 years. So I paid a little money, had everything sent to me, all the audio recordings, all the notes, and it was a treasure trove of material. So all the obstacles stunk, but finding that and hearing 28-year-old Bo Jackson talk to Dick Schaap in recordings that have never been released before made it much easier.
Mm. And of the 720 different people that you interviewed for the writing of this book, what would be one or two of the most noteworthy, interviews that were particularly fruitful for your efforts?
I interviewed, when Bo was at Auburn, his backfield mate was a guy named Lionel James, Lionel Little Train James. And I got him late in the process. And he actually wound up dying a few months ago. He was only 60 and he died tragically young. But he was amazing. And the thing we talked about a lot that I was really, really, really into, and that Bo did not touch at all in his autobiography, is being an African-American kid showing up at Auburn in the early 80s as an athlete. And, you know, Lionel James told me, Bo and Lionel roomed together at Auburn. And during Bo's sophomore year, the athletic dormitory Sewell Hall was under renovation. So they took all the athletes and put them in trailers, mobile units around town in Auburn. And Lionel James told me that the head coach at the time, Pat Dye, who has since passed, pulled them aside and said, listen, I know you guys are dating white women. He goes, it is totally fine. You have a right to do that. It probably won't go over well here in Auburn. And you guys are football players representing the school. I'm going to put you guys in a housing unit that's pretty far away from campus, so people won't see the white women coming and going from where you live. And it was striking, first of all, but it was also interesting because Lionel James actually appreciated Pat Dye doing it because he knew Pat Dye was kind of trying to keep them out of trouble. But what Lionel James elaborated to say to me that I've never forgotten and I don't think I'll ever forget, is he said there was a game against Florida when he broke all five of his fingers. And all the Auburn fans are cheering him and loving him, and he's broken his fingers. And he was wondering afterwards, like, do they even care about me? Would they let me date their daughter? Am I just, and use the N-word, am I just a, you know, blank running a football? Do I matter to them? Do they care about me? And I think a lot of African-American players in the Deep South during that period really had those thoughts. And Lionel James just stated them beautifully.
Hmm. We're speaking with Jeff Perlman, author of The Last Folk Hero, The Life and Myth of Bo Jackson. Bo Jackson, a name that looms large in sports history as one of the great athletes of the 20th century. Sadly, a name that is not nearly as well remembered as one might assume. One of the things I really appreciate about your book, Mr. Perlman, is the way in which you give us an unvarnished and illuminating account of Bo Jackson's childhood in Bessemer, Alabama. And it's a difficult childhood. He is being raised essentially by a single mom, one of 11 kids. It's a childhood of deprivation, no running water in the house, wearing only hand-me-downs, and life is just not easy. And there are ways in which life becomes still more difficult for this young boy, and one of them is that he was a fairly severe stutterer. Just say a quick word about the effect that you think this had on Bo Jackson at that point in time and really leading into his adulthood. I mean, obviously that was something he began to get a handle on, but what were sort of the most far-reaching consequences of the fact that on top of everything else, he had a stutter?
Well, it's really crazy. You know, as you alluded to, he literally wore his sister's hand-me-down shoes to school. Not his brother's, his sister's. And when shoes didn't fit, he would go in socks. to school, which is absolutely crazy. And so he already was facing severe sort of obstacles as far as poverty, as far as a mom who worked three jobs. He was held back a grade. And he had this stutter. And he was really, really sensitive about it. And it was a severe stutter. It wasn't a light stutter. And there's a moment that actually just crushed me as a reporter, which is he's in English class in high school. His teacher's name was Grace Parsons. And Bo Jackson cheated on a test. And the teacher thought the punishment that would be appropriate, knowing that he stuttered, was to have him stand before the class and read How Do I Love Thee, the poem by Elizabeth Barrett Browning. And I can't think of a meaner thing to do to a kid. Like, you know he's a severe stutterer, and here's how I'm going to punish you. You're going to have to stand there. And a classmate told me he actually read the poem well, but he just always felt it. He couldn't escape it. It was there. And people would, back then, especially in rural, poor, black Alabama, it wasn't like there were speech therapists at your school at McAdory High to help you. And basically what happened is he goes to Auburn. And when he's at Auburn, they're, you know, you're facing a lot of media. You're facing a lot of cameras. They notice he struggles. And David Housel was the sports information director, and he lined Bo up with theater professors, and he started taking classes, theater classes, and TV and media classes, and learning about how to speak confidently, how to control a stutter, how to take your time, not to have to fight. Don't fight through every word. You don't have to get through the I really quickly. You can elongate it. You can pause. And it changed his life, and if you hear him speak today, you notice he speaks very deliberately, and that's straight from what he learned at Auburn.
Hmm. One of the things you do to also help us understand his early life is you help us understand the kind of racial segregation that occurred in Bessemer, Alabama, and also more specifically in the high school where he attended and, of course, where he became such a superstar. But it's really interesting to read, especially about that high school, and the things that were allowed and not allowed and the written rules and the unwritten rules that essentially separated the races.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's as a kid who grew up in New York in the 80s, it's like writing about a different world completely. I mean, I talked to one offensive lineman, and he told me he swore by this. And he actually said to me, Bo will never admit this, but I promise you it's true. This guy was a white offensive lineman. And he said one time he and a bunch of his other linemen were at they had a drive-in movie theater not far from town. And they saw Bo Jackson with a white girl at the movie theater. And they had a game the next night. And first Bo Jackson carry, this guy said, the whole offensive line just moved out of the way and let Bo get pummeled. And Bo Jackson gets tackled, stands up, looks at the lineman and says, what was that for? And the guy goes, don't mess around with the white girls. And Bo Jackson nodded, and the game continued. There were the black kids were largely from the poor part of Bessemer. The white kids were not. There are all these rules. You could give a black kid teammate a ride home if you were white. You couldn't go in his house. A black teammate would not go into your house. I interviewed one cheerleader who told me about there were two black cheerleaders on the cheerleading squad at McAdory High. A lot of the other parents would not drive them to events, but some families would. There's no way in hell you would have a boyfriend or girlfriend of a different race. It wasn't that long ago. It was the 80s, but it was a very, very, very sort of stilted times in Alabama.
Hmm. One of the most interesting passages in the book is when you talk about three moments that could have changed everything. Moments in young Bo Jackson's life when he came extremely close to, for instance, grabbing a gun and shooting someone out of anger, out of retaliation for something done. Three different instances, and chances are perhaps there were even more. And you take a little bit of time to do this, and I think you do so for a really, really important purpose. Explain why you take the time to tell us about these moments that, in your words, could have changed everything.
Well, when he was a little kid, he was raised in a sort of a violent world, and he did have access to a gun, and he saw, he was beating the crap out of people. He saw people beating the crap out of people. And, one time he's at a pool hall, a rec center near his house, and he's only 12 years old, and he's waiting to play ping pong. And another kid takes the ping pong paddle and sort of digs her fingers into his hand. And he comes back with an aluminum bat and starts beating the crap out of the person, right? Which is absolutely insane. And then there's another time he's offended by someone and he takes a gun and follows this person, someone who had the audacity of like skipping him in line in pool. And he has a gun and he has it cocked at him. And he winds up just not shooting. And then there's another instance where, with a gun where he's about to shoot a kid, literally is about to shoot a kid. And Bo had a brother who went to reform school, an older brother. And his older brother would tell him, and I don't know if he was exaggerating or not, that at reform school, a lot of the kids would sexually assault each other. There'd be a lot of sexual assaults. And that scared the crap out of Bo Jackson. And that's sort of what held him back from doing certain things. It would run through his mind, I can't go to reform school because I don't want to get sexually assaulted. And I just think it's interesting, like, the reason I wrote about it is because the thin line for Bo Jackson between becoming this iconic megastar, Nike pitchman, one of the biggest athletes of all time, and being just another kid from rural African-American Alabama in prison is really thin and really narrow. And he walked on that edge several times before finding sports.
Hmm. And finding sports, he did, of course, a spectacular success story, initially on the track team and ultimately on the football team and baseball teams as well. And ultimately finds his way to Auburn University. One of the things that is most amazing about the amazing Bo Jackson is that when he gets to Auburn, he's not the biggest sports story at Auburn, even amongst the newcomers on the campus, which also speaks to the circumstances under which he emerged and ultimately came to Auburn University. Explain what I'm talking about.
Well, it's interesting. He's first of all, Charles Barkley is there when he's there, which is kind of funny. And Frank Thomas, a former White Sox slugger, is there at the end when he's there too. Rowdy Gaines, the Olympic diver, it's a loaded, loaded campus. But he comes to Auburn, and he's the number five recruit in the state of Alabama. And the number one football recruit in the state of Alabama happens to be a running back named Allen Evans from Enterprise, Alabama. And he's on the team. And he's the guy everyone's talking about. They're not talking about Bo Jackson. They're talking about Allen Evans, who's kind of like a Barry Sanders type, shifty and, you know, twirly and kind of short but dynamic. And after about 3 days of practices, Allen Evans is figured out. Like, they just kind of figure him out. All right, if you wait on his moves, blah, 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 and he's not a good blocker. And after about 3 days, the otherworldly athleticism of Bo Jackson is just preposterous. And he's run. There's a moment in an inter-squad scrimmage that Auburn had a great defensive lineman named Donnie Humphrey, who was considered just a bad, bad man. And he was talking a lot of trash to Bo before the game. Oh, you think you're this? And Bo steamrolls him in the game, like just runs over him. And after the game, Humphrey approaches him and says, you know what, man? You are the baddest man on the planet. I was wrong. You are right. And just really quickly, he emerged. And you know what? I don't write about this in a book that much, but there's something even just about his name, like Bo Jackson. It just sounds cool. It's made for a bumper sticker, which they sold. It's made for hats, which they sold. Like, everything about him, the physique, the speed, the size, the name, it's just made for a Southern football folk hero.
Hmm. And, of course, Bo Jackson goes on to tremendous success, wins the Heisman Trophy while he's at Auburn, and he's an important member of the baseball team, although he has some struggles on the baseball team. And this speaks to some of the struggles that he would also have even when he broke into Major League Baseball. I mean, and that's the first professional sport he played. For all of his astonishing natural abilities, what was it that held him back from being entirely successful at first at Auburn and also certain deficiencies in his game, even when he breaks into the majors?
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, first of all, unlike a lot of baseball players in college and major league, he obviously wasn't devoting himself year-round to the game. So, and he really had very minimal experience. McAdory wasn't a high-level high school team. So he comes to Auburn, and he's oozing with athleticism, and he's oozing with power and speed, but he doesn't have experience. And he can't hit a curveball. He can't hit a slider. He can't recognize the pitches. He actually wrote in his autobiography that he went 0 for 21 with 21 strikeouts in his first 21 at-bats. And that wasn't true or even remotely true. He went 2-for-5 in his first game against Southern Illinois, beating out a grounder to short for his first major league hit. But then he went 1-for-19 after that. He really did struggle. And, you know, he quit after his freshman year because the coach of the team, Paul Nix, was a tyrant who would actually yell at his players during games through a bullhorn. And Bo just didn't have time for that. So he quit, and then he came back when they hired Hal Barrett as a new coach, and he became this phenomenon. But same with the Royals. Like, he shows up in Kansas City. He's a physical freak of nature. No one's ever seen. He's basically Mike Trout talent-wise. He's Mike Trout talent-wise. But he's not fully committed to baseball. And I think people always ask me, like, what could he have become? What if he had just played baseball? Well, if he had just played baseball and never touched a football, he's Mickey Mantle. The problem is he didn't really run routes well, like he in the outfield. He didn't run the bases particularly well. He didn't move runners over. He would get fooled easily. Couldn't identify pitches. So he was physically gifted, but he was, you know, his experience level never matched the gifts.
How hard a choice was it out of Auburn to choose professional baseball over professional football? I mean, obviously, as a Heisman Trophy winner, the NFL desperately wanted him. What do we understand about Bo Jackson's choice at that point? I mean, although he ultimately, of course, played both sports, but what was the draw to baseball over football at that point in his life?
Well, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers made it a far easier decision than it should have been because he was a senior at Auburn playing baseball. And the Buccaneers flew him to Tampa Bay to take a physical because they knew he was going to be that they were going to have the number one pick and he was the obvious number one choice. And somehow or another, Bo always blamed them in hindsight. I still don't believe they did it on purpose. It wouldn't make sense. But that flight to Tampa to take a physical cost him half a season of college baseball. He actually was deemed ineligible because he wasn't allowed to take that flight, and someone gave him bad information. So he returns from Tampa Bay after getting his physical, and the coach, Hal Barrett, says, "Where were you?" He's like, "I was in Tampa Bay taking a physical." And he said, "Wait, how'd you get to Tampa Bay?" "Oh, the Buccaneers owner flew me in." And Hal Barrett knew right then Bo Jackson's baseball career was over. And as soon as he was ruled ineligible in baseball, he basically took on the posture of, you know, screw the Buccaneers. And they used the number one pick on him. And it's actually really funny. They drafted number one overall. They figured they could sign him. They figured money would woo him. And he actually flew to Tampa to meet with the owner, Hugh Culverhouse. And he had dinner with Steve Young, the Buccaneers quarterback in Hugh Culverhouse. And Steve Young was brought there to help woo Bo Jackson. And when Hugh Culverhouse leaves the table, Bo Jackson leans into Steve Young and says, "Just so you know, man, there's no effing way I'm signing with this team." And Steve Young's like, "Okay, I guess my recruitment is done here." And when the Royals drafted him in the fourth round, I mean, he loved his visit with the Royals. He liked the organization. The scout, Kenny Gonzalez, was all about him. It wasn't that hard of a decision because he hated the Buccaneers so much.
Hmm. So, of course, he ultimately does opt to also play professional football for the Raiders. And one of the things you tell us in the book is that when he signed with the Raiders, the Royals were absolutely furious. I mean, it was, as far as they were concerned, a moment of betrayal. Explain why that choice that Bo Jackson made to just essentially play football in the off season, when in effect, you know, one would sort of think that was his time to do with as he chose, why that was such a blow to the Royals and why it was received the way it was.
Well, a couple of reasons. Number one, the Royals had invested a lot of money and a lot of time in Bo Jackson, and he needed a lot of development. Like, off-season, it almost is misused in the way we think of it. It's off-season for Major League games, but it's on-season for working on your craft, playing Fall League, going to the Dominican, somewhere in Latin America, working on your craft, playing games, working with coaches, etc. And he needed that desperately. And the other thing is, the Royal players were furious. Because, you know, you're Willie Wilson or George Brett or Frank White or Steve Balboni, and you've been a Royal for 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years, and in your contract you can't water ski, or you can't play basketball, you can't ride a motorcycle. And, oh, but this guy, who's all of 23 years old, can play in the NFL? Like, it really infuriated these guys in major, major ways. They felt like the organization was violating them. They felt like the organization was catering to this young, sort of arrogant kid who didn't deserve it. There were a lot of wedges formed in that Royals clubhouse over Bo going to play football.
Of course, your book goes on to chronicle his extraordinary exploits on both the baseball field and the football field. We can, of course, leave it to our listeners to explore that in your book. And in some ways, some of that is the most sort of publicly available information about Bo Jackson are those achievements during his pro career. Of course, everything changes, and I think it was 1991 with the devastating injury that he suffered in a Raiders game. And that spells the end of his football career, and it certainly shortens his baseball career as well. Explain the nature of this injury to Bo Jackson's hip. And, I mean, because it's kind of a complicated story about more than just an injury.
Yeah, well, it was called a vascular necrosis, and basically he was running in a playoff game against the Bengals. A linebacker named Kevin Walker grabbed him from behind and basically held onto his leg really tight as Bo was using all his force to go forward, and it caused his hip to leave the socket. And he's down on the ground, and he feels this intense pain, like a stabbing pain, and he actually puts his hip back in, which is beyond belief, but he actually put his hip back in his socket, and he limps off the field, and everyone thinks he'll be okay, and it's Bo Jackson. Obviously, he's indestructible. And he goes for a scan in the coming days, and the doctor says to him, Bo, you see all that black by your hip in the x-ray in the scan? And he says, yeah. And he says, that's all blood pooling right there. It's all blood. And Bo Jackson said it's really the only time he ever felt like he was going to pass out from something. And basically what this disease does is it starts killing your hip. It actively is killing the bone and muscles in your body and renders your hip ultimately dead, like a ghost hip. And the Royals released him. The whole thing was really heartbreaking. The Royals had told him not to play football. Don't play football. Don't play football. What if you get hurt? What if you get hurt? He gets hurt. The Royals don't believe the injury is that severe. Sign him to a $2 million contract. That doesn't kick in until after spring training. He comes to spring training on crutches. He can't do a thing. He keeps exaggerating how he's doing great and it's going to get better, but it's not getting better. The Royals figure it out. And when he's not even there, when he's in Alabama seeing a doctor for a second opinion, they announce they're releasing him. And he vows revenge and I'm going to come back and I'm going to show the Royals, but he never does. He comes back. It's an amazing return. He gets a hip replacement. He has some semi-productive years with Chicago and then the Angels, but he's never the same. The hip is never the same. He can't run the same. He doesn't have the same power. And he plays his last year with the California Angels in 1994. The strike ends that season early. And his last game is actually an amazing thing. In his last game, he stole his only base of the year and his only attempt at steal of the year. And after the game, the stadium's dark. Everyone's leaving. The strike's about to begin. It's over. He walks out to second base with no one looking but the general manager from his office above, takes the base out of the ground, and walks back into the dugout. And that was the last time Bo Jackson ever appeared as an active player on a major league field.
So that stolen base, in a sense, stolen in two different respects, but a keepsake, yep, for an important moment in his career. You tell us in the book that for as maddening as it all is, that it all comes to an end so abruptly and so painfully in more ways than one, that he has very little in the way of regret, and that also he looks back on his life and his achievements with an astonishing degree of humility and even grace.
Oh, yeah. He, of all the people you hear saying, oh, it's such a shame. Like, every now and then there'll be some poll on social media. What athlete was robbed of blah, blah, blah? Or what athlete should we have seen his end, blah, blah, blah? And it's always Bo Jackson. And the one guy who probably wouldn't answer Bo Jackson is Bo Jackson. He's never given a second thought to it. He's never regretted playing football. He had this wild ride. He did something no one else had done before. And I actually think he has a really good perspective on the Hall of Fames, the Baseball and Football Hall of Fames, neither of which he's in, which is, who cares? Like, I've enjoyed my life, and I have three great kids, and I'm a grandpa now. He has a grandson, and I've had a good business career. And you guys can talk about it all you want, and that's fine. Also, you're never going to see him on TV. saying, like, I know Breece Hall is good, but I was better. Like, never. You'll never see him doing that. He's not that guy. He's just kind of separated himself, watches golf, plays a lot of golf, shuffles his own driveway, drives a Ford truck, likes to hunt, and just moved on. It makes him far more interesting than if he were on TV every week calling, like, Auburn games.
Well, the book is really something, and we have only scratched the surface of it. Its title, again, The Last Folk Hero, The Life and Myth of Bo Jackson, published by Mariner Books, the author, Jeff Perlman. Jeff Perlman, it was a great pleasure to speak with you once again, and congrats on this terrific book.
Thank you, and thank you for reading it. I really appreciate it.